Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Last Thursday was an important deadline for the 55th Oklahoma Legislature, as House and Senate bills needed to be passed in their originating chamber for further consideration for passage into law. And while the headlines have focused on which bills are still alive and which are dead for this session, deliberations on the biggest issue confronting this year's legislature, the estimated $1.3 billion shortfall expected for next year's budget, is taking place largely behind closed doors and not in the public forums of the legislature. This week, the legislature is meeting only in pro forma sessions and are largely in recess. But beginning next week, Senate bills and House bills that have passed will move to their opposite chambers for consideration amid an overall deadline of May 27th to end the session. Joining me to talk about where the legislature is on those key bills and on addressing the shortfall is Gene Perry. He's the policy director for the Oklahoma Policy Institute, and he joins us with a legislative update. Gene Perry, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a very busy Oklahoma legislative session, mainly because of this huge cloud hanging over the state and in the budget shortfalls for the current year, as well as the looming budget shortfall for the next fiscal year. And yet, when you see the news coming out of the legislature, it's about almost everything but the budget. What's going on in Oklahoma City?
There has been a lot of activity on a lot of different issues, but you're right that we haven't really seen a lot of movement yet on what they're going to do about this big budget problem. I think a lot of that is because when you start to get down to what you do about it, you start to make people upset, whether they're going to be the ones who get their budgets cut or whether they get a tax incentive taken back or some other tax increase out there. So lawmakers are hesitant to kind of put those ideas out and run them through the normal process. Now, what we are likely to see as we get closer to the end of the session and they have to come up with an answer to the budget is there'll be some kind of deal made, and we'll see these things suddenly appear again that have been discussed throughout the session.
Now, of course, granted, part of the issue has been the fact that they have had to deal with the budget shortfall in this fiscal year.
Yeah.
And there seemed to be some debate over whether to use the rainy day fund or not. Was there a general agreement to use the rainy day fund to help shore up education and corrections, or was that really a contentious issue at the legislature?
Well, it seemed at first when it was announced that there was, on top of the 3% budget cuts that had come in the middle of the year, they were going to do another 4%, which was surprising even to us at OK Policy. That was larger than we were expecting. And it was going to do some real damage to schools and corrections and all other areas, but those in particular were clearly going to do some damage. So the governor pretty quickly came out to say we should use the rainy day fund, and the Senate leadership came out to say that. And on the House side, that's where there seemed to be some hesitancy. The House leadership was questioning whether they should do that, but there was a pretty strong push from education, especially because there was the likelihood of things like four-day school weeks in Tulsa and all sorts of other places, ending school bus programs, ending athletics programs. And so there was a recognition that, yeah, we need to shore them up and prevent some of those cuts right now.
Now, the rest of the state agencies are seeing that 4% cut, correct?
Yeah. And we're already seeing some pretty significant cuts due to that. The health department in particular has talked about ending funding for child abuse prevention programs next year and closing county health departments in a bunch of different places. There's been major buyouts at the Department of Human Services and in other areas where agencies are really paring back and taking away programs that are, I think nobody would say, are wasteful or unnecessary, but just the money's not there to fund them.
Now, taking money from the rainy day fund for this year means there'll be less to use for next year, correct?
Yeah, though there is a 3/8 of the rainy day fund that is reserved just for mid-year shortfalls. So it's not something that was going to go into next year's budget either way. Now, if we have another mid-year shortfall next year, then that won't be available for that. But this is a portion of the rainy day fund that is for that purpose.
Well, this past Thursday was a big deadline in the legislature for a bill making it out of one section of the legislature, the House or the Senate, to be considered by the other body, had to make it out of one body of the House or the Senate to be considered for further action. You know, there were several things that have come across unrelated to budget directly, although one that everyone has been talking about is, will the state, given the budget shortfall for next year, accept some form of Medicaid expansion, which would have an immediate injection of federal dollars into the state? But what has passed the House is actually a Medicaid contraction, which will probably boot, what is it, around 111,000 Oklahomans off the current Medicaid rolls.
Yeah, that's what they've tried to do. The House passed a bill that would basically kick off all able-bodied adults, which in the current Medicaid program is only parents of dependent children making less than half of the poverty level. So that's making less than $7,000, $8,000 a year. Now, the caveat to that is it's very unlikely that the federal government is going to allow us to do that. What it does is instruct us to apply for a waiver to ask for that, but those waivers are granted to allow pilot programs that are attempts to make Medicaid do a better job of insuring people, and just kicking people off their insurance to save money is not going to fit that bill. And so it seems unlikely that we're going to even be able to do that. And in the meantime, it seems pretty tragic that a lot of people are probably being scared right now that they're going to lose their insurance.
So is this a shell bill? I mean, is it just sort of a, you know, we're making a show of this, and they're counting on the federal government to say, no, you can't do that?
What we've heard, I think, and what the author of the bill, Representative Doug Cox, has said is that he is frustrated that there's not been the kind of progress in some of the revenue options that we would need to prevent these kind of really serious cuts. And so he's putting things out there to try to get across the magnitude of what could happen. Now, unfortunately, it seems a lot of other legislators took that and ran with it and said, okay, let's do this.
So this was sort of a gambit by Representative Cox, who has been a proponent of Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, he has. And it does seem pretty tragic that Oklahoma is pursuing this when there is so much federal money available that could actually help with the state budget while increasing the number of people with insurance.
Now, what are you hearing about a possible Medicaid expansion? I've heard a lot of scuttlebutt that we're going to use Insure Oklahoma, we're going to try to get a waiver like Arkansas did, and we will run as far away as we can from the label Obamacare, but we will we're trying to figure out a way to accept Medicaid expansion. Are you hearing that among legislators?
That does seem to be the most likely plan if Oklahoma does finally move to accept the funds to put it to Insure Oklahoma rather than traditional Medicaid. And we're not, at least so far, seeing movement on that by legislators themselves. But with the current budget problems, it does seem to be now more than ever a time when that would be a really good idea to do.
But if I can qualify that, what you're hearing is legislators are not really talking about this really
too
much.
They're not talking about it, but again, it's the kind of thing, because it's so politically fraught, that if and when they decide to do it, it's not going to be something that they've sent out a bunch of press releases ahead of time about.
Well, there's several other issues. There's been a number of bills looking at criminal justice reform, everything from bills that would allow an ex-con to be more easily accepted by a professional board, so open more fields of employment for them once they're out of prison, to loosening of penalties. One which sort of gets a lot of press here in Tulsa County is the number of people who have had fines that end up going back to jail because they're unable to pay the fines, and so it will give judges more leeway to lessen or waive fines in a situation where it might be 10 days in jail and, you know, $1,000 fine or something like that. So they can serve their penalty and move on. What is the status of those criminal justice bills?
So there is a good number of criminal justice bills that have moved through their originating chambers and do seem to be making progress. That does seem to be a bright spot this legislative session. As you mentioned, there was the bill to allow drug courts to waive certain fines. There's another bill that would reduce fines by 3% for every it's either 6 months or a year, but for every certain amount of time that somebody serves their sentence on good behavior, so it simultaneously reduces the impact of these fines and fees on people and also provides another tool to maintain discipline within prisons.
And for those that haven't had a lot of experience with the criminal justice system, a lot of times you will get incarceration and a fine, correct?
Yeah, incarceration, and then they come out of incarceration with maybe 10,000 or more in fines, and of course it's really difficult to get a job, to get transportation, and so it's really difficult to pay off those fines and even start to rebuild their lives.
So what seems to have the greatest likelihood of passing? What are we likely to see in the final analysis? Is there some bipartisan support for this?
Yeah, so the bill I just mentioned to reduce fines over time, that's actually sponsored by the House Speaker, Jeff Hickman. So that's got a lot of powerful support behind it. There's a slate of bills that came out of Governor Fallon's task forces that she put together that brought a pretty broad coalition together, including judges and district attorneys and reintegration folks and, you know, law enforcement and people working for victims' rights and defendants' rights. And they all came out with these proposals that have moved through in a slate of bills by Representative Pam Peterson. So that includes things like changing the cutoff for a misdemeanor theft or property crime to turn into a felony from $500 to $1,000, making it on the discretion of DAs to charge drug possession as a felony or a misdemeanor, so allowing, you know, more leeway on those charges, and you're not going to put people in prison or having a felony record for some of these low-level crimes. So we're encouraged by those.
Now, given Oklahoma's politics, where you commit the crime could be a big difference in whether you're charged with a misdemeanor or a felony. I mean, I could see a lot of rural counties where it may be a misdemeanor in the big urban centers, it'll be a felony still in the rural counties.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually a ballot initiative that started collecting signatures just last week would do something very similar along those lines, but it would change it across the board and not do the DA discretion. So it would make drug possession a misdemeanor everywhere. And it would do the same thing that is also moving through in the bill to change the property crime threshold from 500 to 1,000.
Now, you mentioned initiative petitions. And when we go to vote for president this coming November and voting for our representatives, we're going to see a lot of state questions.
Yeah.
I've heard anything from 10 to 12. I mean, we may have three or four on allowing liquor and wine sales in grocery stores and convenience stores alone.
Yeah, I think it was Senate President Bingaman who joked that voters are going to have to bring a sandwich into the voting booth because there is going to be a lot. There's those that you mentioned. There's a bill to put the death penalty in the state constitution to say this is something that is allowed in Oklahoma. There's the right to farm bill that's going to be very contentious.
And there's a lawsuit against that to keep it from getting on the ballot,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the initiative petition to increase the sales tax by 1% and use that to fund education.
Yeah. Well, speaking of education, there were a number of education bills. One that got the full-scale attention of the education community was a voucher bill that was up in the House. And for the longest time, it looked like passage was a foregone conclusion. But all of a sudden, when rubber met the road, all of a sudden the leadership didn't have the votes and they did not bring it up for a vote. So that voucher bill is dead.
Yeah. Though I would say passage of that bill was always contentious and close. Like when it came through the committee this year, they had to bring in the House leadership just to add some votes to get it to pass committee. It almost failed in committee. And then when it was coming to the floor, there was Governor Fallon was on the phone doing robocalls, trying to get people to call their legislators and push that. And there was definitely a large amount of pressure, but it seems that they found that they didn't have the votes at the end of the day, and so they didn't bring it to a vote.
And so we should say that the Republican caucus remains divided on this issue.
Yeah, there was a big division on that issue, and a big division really fueled by the advocacy by parents and teachers and people who care about education to say, especially with this much of a budget shortfall, is not the time to be taking money and moving it out of public education and into private schools or other places.
How big a factor was that, do you suppose, given the time of the budget shortfall and the budget situation as it exists? How big a mitigating factor was that in the voucher bill?
I think that was significant. I think that that's helped to fuel a lot of the education advocacy that has happened, but I think it still would have gone through if it had not been for so many people calling their legislators and speaking out.
Now, while that voucher bill did not pass the legislature, while education advocates were fighting that bill, there was another bill that did pass one house, and that was loosening the requirements for school districts, which could be everything from meeting standards to teacher accreditations, loosening accreditations, which some school districts are probably going to have to do given the situation. There's a teacher shortage in the state. And also not contributing to their retirement system, which that was news to me. What's going on with this bill?
Yeah, so this is a Senate bill, and the rationale behind this bill is that it would allow districts to apply to opt out of a whole bunch of standards that we require for public schools today. So that includes contributing to teacher retirement funds, that includes the minimum teacher salary schedule, that includes teacher certification requirements. And the idea that has been presented by the authors is that you can do things like bring in part-time adjunct-style professors or other people who aren't kind of the traditional teacher mold, and it gives schools more flexibility. And on the one hand, there's an argument for allowing some of this experimentation by schools, and this would have to be adopted on a school-by-school basis. But on the other hand, with schools under so much financial pressure, it seems very possible and maybe likely that schools would do this not just to get flexibility, but because they can't afford to hire and employ traditional teachers. And so that would be unfortunate.
My guest today is Gene Perry, Policy Director for the Oklahoma Policy Institute. As we get a legislative update, last Thursday was the deadline for non-revenue, non-budget bills to pass one chamber of the legislature. So some bills are still alive. Many bills are dead for this session, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk about the budget. This is the thing that is surprising even longtime outsiders, how little discussion there is about the upcoming year. You have $1.3 billion, $1.1 if you use some of the revolving accounts and some of the other ways to whittle that down that we've used in past years. What are you hearing from Oklahoma City as of how they're going to get $1.1 billion either of extra revenue or tax cuts or expenditure cuts or the mixture of the two to get a balanced budget?
Yeah. So far, we haven't seen a lot of progress on what they're really going to do to fix this big, big problem, and something that could translate to 20% cuts to all state services unless they bring something on the revenue side. Governor Fallon presented some ideas at the beginning of the year, like extending the sales tax to cover services, like increasing the tobacco tax. And those definitely do not seem to have gone anywhere. There was a bill to increase the tobacco tax that was withdrawn because it simply had very, very little support. There was a bill to extend the sales tax to more services, but that got transformed into a bill to just create a committee of people who are going to make a plan for comprehensive tax reform in some future year. So that's, again, creating a committee and not really doing anything.
There was a Senate bill to reverse the latest income tax cut. That did not make it out of the Senate.
Yeah, and so there was a bill to stop the income tax cut that was kicking in this year, as well as end another tax break that seems to be one of the most wasteful on the books, which is the double deduction for state income taxes. But this, even though it passed the Senate with a large bipartisan majority of 10-2 passed the Senate committee, it was not allowed a hearing in the Senate. And the Senate leadership and House leadership and Governor Fallon all spoke out against it. So that seems to be something that even though if it was allowed a vote, there does appear to be a possibility that there's enough support for that to go through. The leadership is not going to allow that, at least so far.
So how is this going to come together? By law, they have to have a balanced budget. It does not seem, I don't want to say sane is perhaps not the right word, but it doesn't seem likely that it's going to be straight expenditure cuts.
Yeah.
You know, if you're looking at a 15-18% budget cut, giving everything we've cut over the last 3 to 4 years, just seems like that's not in the cards.
Yeah.
Not possible, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And just looking at what happened just recently with the Rainy Day Fund and the brief debate over whether or not to use that and the sort of things that were coming out that were going to be cut if we didn't boost education and the prison system. I mean, the Department of Corrections was going to go broke and run out of money before the end of the year. And education, like we mentioned, was going to be canceling buses and closing.
Or ending school early.
Ending school early, going to a four-day week. So these would be some really major things that people would feel. And they're going to feel it anyway. There's going to be more cuts. It seems very unlikely that they're going to come up with enough revenue to prevent cuts. But there absolutely needs to be some revenue.
So what are the likelihood of revenue? What's the likelihood of finding new revenue?
One bill that has been moving forward, it would do more to collect sales tax on online purchases. So it would define a little bit more what companies are required to charge sales tax when people are purchasing online. And it would also tell companies who aren't required to do that because they don't have any activity inside Oklahoma other than online to prepare a statement that goes to people who buy from them at the end of the year to say, this is what you bought and this is what you do owe in sales tax, because people owe this tax. It's just there's no way to enforce it under the current laws.
Yeah. Now, there is a provision in the state tax return, but is that really an optional thing for you to fill out? It doesn't read like it's optional.
Yeah, it's not optional. There's just no way to enforce it, really. And that's because of some Supreme Court decisions that have said that states can't do this without a change in Congress. So that's what that really depends on. But it's still under the law. And I think if more people were aware of that, people don't want to skip on their taxes, even if they know that there's not going to be repercussions. And there's just not that knowledge that this is actually something you're supposed to be paying.
Yeah. Well, my guest today is Gene Perry, a policy director for the Oklahoma Policy Institute. We're getting a legislative update. And, of course, during the second half of the session, it will be about getting to a balanced budget. What do you expect the leadership to do? I'm sure they're talking about this behind closed doors. Will they hammer out at an agreement they can all live with and it will just be sent before the legislature to approve? That will probably have a mix of some revenue enhancements. I mean, I don't know. What is the process for even getting revenue enhancements other than an income tax increase, which that triggers this is the constitutional thing, the mm-hmm. state question that 640 that doesn't allow you to raise it without a vote of the people or 3/4 majority, mm-hmm. which I can't find anything in the legislature that would get that.
Yeah.
So how are they going to get this passed?
So in previous years, it very much has been in the last week of session, the budget deal appears and is rushed through as quickly as possible before any of the people who don't like it have time to mobilize against it. I think because of the magnitude of the shortfall this year and how much controversy there is going to be around it, I think we may see at least more debate and more proposals being put out. So even though, for example, some bills to repeal a bunch of tax credits and tax expenditures didn't make it through this first deadline, those could appear again as part of a budget deal and show up in the Appropriations Committee. And so that's one way where we could see a repealing of tax credits and tax expenditures, or at least a capping of them, which seems to be the thing that has the most support as far as a revenue option.
Mm-hmm. So it's not an unlimited tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the first $100 million, something like that, or $50
million. Yeah. Yeah. So we put out these tax credits and say that anybody who does a certain activity or qualifies in a certain way just gets them and can apply for them. But, of course, we don't know exactly how much that's going to cost a lot of times until the people apply. And in a year when we're cutting every other area of government, when we're cutting schools and transportation and public safety and all these things, we're not cutting those tax breaks because that's just going out based on the application. So this would try to at least kind of share that burden when everything is getting cut.
Now you mentioned the Senate bill that would reverse the tax cut that didn't pass the full Senate. Could that come back in a sort of appropriations bill or in a sort of a budget deal?
Technically, it could, and and I would say that would be the right thing to do. Unfortunately, it seems so far that leadership is really pushing back against that idea and didn't allow it to get a hearing in the Senate. So unless there's a lot of pressure from some other area that gets them to do that, that doesn't seem likely to happen.
Could it be also that they didn't want to put it out there so they would have the negotiating flexibility when it comes to the rubber meeting the road at the end of the session to put it in that way? Although the governor has said that's a drop in the hat. It's not even worth, was it $150
million? $150 million. So it's about 10% of next year's budget shortfall. Now, for us, we would say it's not all of it, but we should use everything we can. It's a nice start, especially when we're looking at $1.3 billion. Unfortunately, the governor doesn't seem to see it that way.
Well, you know, as taxpayers, citizens of the state that want to get involved in this, do they really need to wait for that budget agreement to come out to the public? I mean, what's the best way to get feedback to your legislators, considering there's nothing really on the table on how to address the budget shortfall?
Yeah. Well, really, we can't afford to wait until it shows up in the last week of session. And what ends up in that final deal is, I think, going to depend on what legislators have been hearing throughout the year. So people, especially those who are going to be pretty severely affected by budget cuts. So anybody who depends on healthcare services or really cares about schools or any other area needs to be communicating that early and often to legislators and to legislative leadership.
All right. I'm sure you'll be following what happens in the legislature. What's your job over the next 3 months at the Policy Institute to follow these developments?
Mm-hmm. So we are definitely keeping a close eye on everything that's happening and trying to put out information for people who care about these issues and want to get involved in advocating on them or just learning more about them. And we put all that out at okpolicy.org.
All right. Well, Gene Perry, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Gene Perry is the policy director for the Oklahoma Policy Institute, giving us an update on the current 55th Oklahoma legislative session. To learn more about the Policy Institute, visit their website at okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.